All right. So if somebody can just give me a thumbs up, a hello, something, my camera, I did one for face to face earlier today. I know that my camera is not working. The microphone was working earlier, somewhat. Can y'all hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Whew. Okay. All right. So let's start with gastro. So you've got a patient who comes in complaining of frequent indigestion, worse after meals. What are some of the medications that we talked about that we could use to treat that? All right, y'all, we talked about like three different medicine classes that we could use to treat GERD.
The H2 receptors, the cimetidine and
Yes, that's one of them.
proton pump.
Proton pump was one. All right, Sherika, I'm not going to make you answer all the questions again. Does anybody else want to talk or?
I'm just guess the last one. Is it the sulcrophate? If I'm pronouncing
So yes, sulcrophate,
okay.
and then we also had an acids, which was over the counter.
Okay.
All right, I'm not going to let Sherika continue to answer every question. So I'm just going to run through a review. Anyway, all right, so your H2 receptor, you've got cimetidine and famotidine. These are used in the treatment of GERD, peptic ulcer disease, heartburn. We know that. What makes cimetidine unique is that it blocks androgen receptors. And so both cimetidine and famotidine have some central nervous system effects, including lethargy, dizziness, drowsiness. When you're looking at your contraindications for the geriatric population, we need to be careful about our androgens. We also need to be cautious with our COPD and immunosuppressants, taking these medications because it can increase the bacterial colonization. For your cimetidine, it certainly can have interactions with your warfarin, your phenytoin, your theophylline, and lidocaine, and increase those levels. We want to be cautious in using with antacids because antacids will decrease the absorption of your H2 receptor agonist. When you're doing your nursing education, it's going to be very similar to what you would have for your standard treatment of GERD, including the small frequent meals, avoiding foods that promote the secretion of acids, avoiding your NSAIDs, trying to reduce your stress, monitoring for GI bleeds. The next group of medications we talked about was your proton pump inhibitors. Your proton pump inhibitors include omeprazole, pantoprazole. These medications are different from your H2 agonist. Your H2 agonists are going to block the receptor that stimulates secretion of gastric acid. Your proton pump inhibitors actually block the production of the gastric acid. Again, used to treat some of the same conditions, your gastroesophageal reflux disease, peptic ulcers for your proton pump inhibitors. Complications included for both short-term use, and then you have different ones for long-term use. Your short-term use is going to be more of your GI upset. Your long-term is going to revolve more around your osteoporosis, as well as the risk for pneumonia. Proton pump inhibitors are contraindicated in the use of patients who are breastfeeding. They're also contraindicated for children who have dysphagia or liver disease. We should avoid using them in patients who have a high risk for pneumonia. Proton pump inhibitors will interact with your digoxin and phenytoin, increasing those levels. And so if you've got a patient who is on a proton pump inhibitor who is concurrently taking digoxin and phenytoin, they could develop toxic levels quickly due to the proton pump inhibitor. When you're doing your nursing administration, we do not crush, chew, or break the capsules. We don't want to open the capsules. These are going to be medications that are taken once a day. These are maintenance medications. We should certainly encourage the client to avoid those things that increase acid reduction or acid production, including the spicy foods, the caffeines. Teach your client about the risk for GI bleeds and how to find those GI bleeds. Your mucosal protectants include sucralfate. Sucralfate is a protective barrier, and so your H2 agonist, they block the production of, they block the signal that creates the production of gastric acid. Your proton pump inhibitors turn off the pumps, and then your mucosal protectants do not change the amount of acid that is created. All it does is provide a protective barrier and prevents further damage to the mucosal lining. For your mucosal protectants, because it is creating a protectant level around the gastric mucosa, it can't interfere with the absorption of medications, including that of phenytoin, digoxin, warfarin. You can only imagine that if you created this extra barrier in the gastric content or in the gastric mucosa, that medications would have a difficult time being fully absorbed. This medication is a maintenance medication, but requires more frequent dosing. It is usually in a liquid formulation and administered 1 hour before meals and then again at bedtime. It does, however, come in a tablet, and you should not break the tablet. Your antacids, these are going to act by neutralizing gastric acid. The acid is already produced. It's not changing the amount of acid. It's not reducing the amount of acid. It is also not protecting the mucosa. It is neutralizing the gastric acid that has already been produced. And so antacids are typically what you will find over the counter. It's your Tums, Rolaids, you know, all of those different variations of it. This is not something that you're necessarily going to administer in a hospital setting. You need to understand this medication because you're going to be teaching patients, how to use this medication correctly. They should take the tablets, chew the tablets thoroughly, and then drink it with either water or milk. Compliance is usually an issue. The medication should be administered 1 hour and then again 3 hours after meals, and then can be taken at bedtime. So it does take quite a bit at a very frequent duration to help to neutralize those stomach acids. Your laxatives, we talked about 3 different kinds of laxatives. We talked about the bulk forming. This is going to be used for patients who have just generalized intermittent constipation. Your bulk forming increases the fecal mass, helping, it basically works very similar to your dietary fiber. And so this is used a lot of times as a daily treatment for H-related constipation. Your surfactants actually are more for long-term. So a situation where you would use this, you've got an elderly patient who is taking in less dietary fiber just due to decreased activity levels, decreased nutritional intake, they're going to be on your bulk forming. That's going to be your Metamucil. That's going to be your Miralax. You've got the next type would be more, you've got a patient who is inpatient, who maybe they've been on narcotic pain medications, their GI activity has been decreased because of lack of mobility, as well as the narcotic pain medication. They are going to be on the surfactant. That's going to be your Docusate. It is not recommended for daily use. And then the third type of laxative we talked about was your stimulant. That is going to be used for prep for either colon procedures or for situations where you have some type of significant blockage that is causing symptomatic. So make sure you're using the right laxative in the right situation. When you're looking at your nursing recommendations for your laxatives, just remember that we need to make sure that patients are using their laxatives appropriately, and that chronic use of laxatives can create situations where patients have imbalanced fluid volume as well as electrolyte volumes. We know that the large intestine is very important in the reabsorption of those electrolytes. And so if we're using laxatives to create frequent bowel movements, we can actually deplenish the electrolytes, creating that imbalance. Anytime we're on any type of laxatives, we want to make sure that we're increasing our fluid intake. And then when we're administering our bulk forming, which we said that was going to be our Metamucil and our Miralax, as well as our Docusate, we want to make sure that we're administering that with a full 8 ounces of water. Next, you've got your anti-diarrheas. You've got the diphenoxylate plus atropine and the loperamide. Basically, these work within the GI tract to activate the opioid receptors that decrease intestinal motility. So uses are going to be for patients who are having frequent stools as well as loose watery stools. We have to be very careful with our dosing because at very high dose, not at very, but at excessive doses, clients can experience an opioid effect. And so we want them to take this for no more than, I typically tell my patients, 1 to 2 days, and we want to be cautious in how many times a day we take it. I prefer you take it only once to twice, but anything more than 2 to 3 days is going to increase that risk for that opioid effect. We want to make sure that our patients are aware of the potential for that electrolyte and imbalance that comes with diarrhea. And so not necessarily that the anti-diarrhea is causing it, but if we're administering an anti-diarrhea, I'm assuming it's because we have diarrhea. And so we just want to make sure that we're maintaining fluid and electrolyte balances in those patients. When they're on these medications, be sure that we are letting them know that they need to take only as needed. Next, you've got your iron preparations. This is used for patients who have iron deficiency anemia. And so we know that these medications come in different forms. You can have the oral, and you can also have the parenteral, which is either IM or IV. The most common side effect for your iron preparations is going to be your significant GI distress. It causes significant nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. The second most common is going to be the staining, and that can be either tooth staining if you're taking the liquid formulation of iron, or if you're giving an IM, it is usually staining of the skin surrounding it. On your nursing administration, because of that significant GI distress, we know that iron is best absorbed on an empty stomach, and so we would advise patients who tolerate it well to take it 1 hour before meals. However, if they do develop the GI distress, we can have them take it with food to help decrease the risk of significant GI disturbance. If the patient is taking the iron supplementations long-term, we do need to go ahead and inform them that they can have a change in the color of their stool. We should let them know that, they need to increase their water and fiber intake to prevent constipation. And we want to do frequent monitoring of their iron and their folate. Next, we have vitamin B12. B12 comes in injectable, oral, and intranasal preparations. We know that vitamin B12 is essential to convert folic acid and to produce DNA production. And so it's used for B12 deficiencies and megaloblastic anemias. One of the things that we need to be aware of when we're administering B12 is that we need to continue monitoring their B12 as well as their hemoglobin, hematocrit, and red blood cell count to make sure that our dosing is effective. A lot of times if a patient has a significantly low vitamin B12, the recommendation is to receive IM injections weekly for a month and then go to monthly. And so every 3 to 6 months, we want to make sure that we're monitoring those lab levels so that we're adequately reaching their B12 needs, but not overdosing them on B12. Obviously, an overdose is not lethal, but it's going to mask other signs and symptoms of folic acid deficiencies. So your folic acid is next. We know that it is essential in the production of DNA as well as for erythropoiesis, which is the creation of your red blood cells, your white blood cells, and your platelets. One of the more important uses of folic acid is it is recommended to be used during pregnancy for the prevention of neural tube defects and birth defects. Another important use that we see often is alcohol use disorder. So your patients who are inpatient who may be suffering from some alcohol withdrawals will usually be given folic acid to help with that. Again, we want to make sure that we're administering correct amounts of folic acid because folic acid and vitamin B12 work interchangeably. We don't want to overload either one of those. It says for your manifestation. Yes.
Sorry. On the, I think it was the laxatives. Didn't you say like the bulk forming was for like more of a maintenance laxative?
Yes, your bulk forming can be taken on a daily basis.
Okay. Thank you.
Lost my train of thought, but that's okay. So your folic acid, we want to make sure that we're assessing them for that megaloblastic anemia. Remember that the megaloblastic anemia, they can have the paresthesias of the hands and feet. And so if they present with some of those symptoms, then you would anticipate a folic acid evaluation as well as supplementation of folic acid. All right, so that's all I got for GI. So for your tissues and pain perception, the first drugs that we talked about was your DMARDs, your disease modifying anti-rheumatic drugs. The two that we focused on was methotrexate as well as hydroxychloroquine. And so we know that both of these medications are immune suppression medications. So we know that especially with your methotrexate, you've also got that bone marrow suppression. So for any of your DMARDs, we want to make sure that we're screening for infectious diseases before starting the medication. We would not administer any live vaccines and would recommend that they take all of their vaccines prior to starting and then maintain a regular schedule of any vaccines. We would monitor for infections, make sure we educate our patients to monitor for infections. Additionally, with your methotrexate, you have the contraindication of pregnancy. And so because it can cause fetal death as well as congenital abnormalities, we want to make sure we educate our patients of childbearing potential to use a reliable form of contraception. Your methotrexate also is hepatotoxic, and so we would avoid any other substances or medications that are hepatotoxic. That includes your Tylenol, alcohol, things like that. The odd thing about your hydroxychloroquine is the retinal damage and potential for blindness. And so we want to make sure that we do a very good visual screening prior to starting that and then routine visual checks throughout the treatment. Your anti-gout medications. So the ones that we talked about for an acute gout attack, acute meaning you are currently having an attack right now and we need to stop that attack. So your attack medicines included colchicine, your non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, as well as your glucocorticoids. Colchicine is the only, is only effective for inflammation caused by gout. It is not used to treat anything other than gout. However, your indomethacin, naproxen, diclofenac, ketorolac, things like that, are just general non-steroidal anti-inflammatories that can be used to treat gout or a number of other conditions. Your prednisone, of course, we've talked about prednisone in multiple other units. Make sure that you go back and review and know the side effects of prednisone and who can and cannot take prednisone. So these medications work to decrease the inflammation that is caused by the accumulation of uric acid. We know that colchicine can cause GI distress, as well as most of your non-steroidal anti-inflammatories can also cause GI distress. And so for those patients who are taking colchicine, we need to make sure that we increase their fluid intake, that we educate them that this medication is used for treatment of an acute gout flare, and that they should not take this medication as prevention. For your prevention medications, we talked about several of those. You've got febuxostat, allopurinol, probenecid. Again, these are for prevention. So these are going to be taken on a daily basis. And so we need to make sure we educate the patients to know the difference between those treating an acute gout attack and those that are used for prevention. We want to make sure, you know, that we have discussed with them as well some of the, you know, those typical, you know, decrease in purine intake, reducing your triggers, increasing your fluid intake, some of those things to help prevent gout attacks. So next, your medications for systemic lupus erythematosus, that is going to be your belimumab. We know this is also a immunosuppressant. And so some of those same things that we just talked about, monitoring for signs and symptoms of infection, you know, teaching your patient to, you know, get your vaccines routinely, but not to take live vaccines. It is an IV solution, and so we want to make sure that we are monitoring that infusion, watching for any infusion reactions, as well as hypersensitivity to the medication. Next are your medications for fibromyalgia. We talked about two different classifications that are used for fibromyalgia. Serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, those are your SNRIs. That includes duloxetine. Your SNRIs work to balance the neurotransmitters serotonin and norepinephrine. We know that serotonin improves mood and that norepinephrine improves focus and decreases pain. And so that works for our patients who have fibromyalgia. We know that our SNRIs carry a black box warning for suicidality. We also know that it can cause some drowsiness, so we need to educate our patients that when they initially start these medications, they should not operate heavy equipment or do, you know, dangerous hobbies because of that risk for drowsiness until they know how the medication is going to affect them directly. Now, the other medication we talked about was your GABA. That's your pregabalin. That's Lyrica. We talked about GABA was the brake pedal of the body. It calms your neural activity. It balances your excitatory signals. And so for your fibromyalgia patients who are having pain, it slows down those neural transmissions, hoping to decrease their pain levels. Your gabapentin, you know, we need to make sure that we, you know, taper the withdrawal of that. Your gabapentin, pregabalin, not gabapentin. I think I said it twice. It's not gabapentin, it's pregabalin. You have to taper the dose of that over at least 1 week. And then with your SNRIs, we want to taper that over 2 weeks. And we talked about that, that withdrawal syndrome with your SNRIs. So we would gradually taper both of those. The next class we talked about was your non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and we talked about first generation as well as second generation. Our first generation inhibits both COX-1 and COX-2. Our second generation is only a COX-2 inhibitor, and where that matters is because it changes some of our complications. So for our first generation, we've got more of the GI discomfort, the kidney impairment. The second generation is going to be your cardiovascular disease. So make sure you understand the difference in your first generation and your second generation non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. You want to make sure that with any of your non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, because of that risk of GI discomfort, that we advise them to take the medication with food or milk, to help decrease the irritation on the gastric mucosa. For your acetaminophen, we use this medication not only for the reduction of fever, but for the relief of pain. The biggest complications that we're going to see with acetaminophen is going to be your hepatotoxicity. And so we would want to make sure that we educate our patients about alcohol consumption, because that is also detrimental to the liver, as well as any other medications that are, hepatotoxic, such as the methotrexate that we talked about earlier in the previous unit. Our maximum recommended dosage for the acetaminophen is 4,000 milligrams per day. And so we want to make sure that our patients understand not to take more than 4,000 milligrams per day. And we know that if the patient has an overdose, that our treatment of that is going to be acetylcysteine, which we've talked about in a previous unit. Next is our opioid agonist. So this is going to be your morphine, your fentanyl, and your oxycodone. This is used to treat moderate to severe pain. It produces analgesia, respiratory depression, euphoria, and sedation. And so because of that respiratory depression, we want to make sure we keep an ambu bag. We want to hold if their respiratory rate falls below 12 per minute. We want to assess for their level of consciousness to assess whether they can handle additional sedation, as well as tolerance. We know that they can develop a dependence on this medication. And so we want to use the lowest dose that provides them adequate pain relief. And we want to taper them off of that as soon as possible. We would not administer any other central nervous system depressants with this medication. And then also we need to, make sure that we're checking those baseline vitals, the respiratory rate, the heart rate. Again, make sure you have the next medicine we're going to talk about, which is the naloxone, as well as respiratory equipment, resuscitation equipment available when you're administering your opioids. So that brings us to the opioid antagonist. And so the two that we talked about was naloxone and naltrexone. And so these medications are used to block the action of the opioid. And so in the absence of an opioid, they have no effect on the patient. And so when we administer these medications, we do need to understand that the half-life of naloxone and naltrexone is usually much shorter than most of our opioids. And so after we have administered this medication, we need to continue monitoring our patient for those respiratory depression, sedation, because they may require an additional dose of naltrexone before the opioid wears off. So then we've got antibiotics was the last section that we talked about. We've got our penicillins. And so the penicillin family works to destroy the cell wall. That's how it kills the bacteria. Your penicillins, your most common complication is going to be allergies as well as anaphylaxis. And so we need to assess our patients' allergies very thoroughly before we administer penicillin. And if you've looked over your slides and remember, there's a bunch of different penicillins. We talked about Pen G, Pen V, amoxicillin, Augmentin, Piperacillin. There's a lot of penicillins. And so, a lot of times you can ask a patient, are you allergic to penicillin? And they'll say, oh no, I'm not allergic to penicillin. And then two breaths later, they say, oh, the only antibiotic I'm allergic to is amoxicillin. You have to remember that your patients don't necessarily know drugs by their classification. They know the name of the drug. And so we highly recommend, instead of saying, are you allergic to penicillin, ask them if they are allergic to any medications and let them provide you the information. So open-ended questions instead of closed, and contraindicated for any previous reaction to penicillins. If the patient is administered a penicillin and develops any rash or difficulty swallowing, swelling, itching, we would DC the medication, notify the provider for a change. Next, you've got your cephalosporins. We talked about four different generations of cephalosporins. These are very broad spectrum. They also destroy the cell wall and have a tendency for a cross sensitivity with your penicillins. So anytime a patient has a penicillin allergy, you want to clarify with your provider before administering a cephalosporin. Additionally, with your cephalosporins is the tendency for bleeding. And so we want to make sure that we have discussed any bleeding history, any anticoagulant use with our patients, as well as checking for renal insufficiency. With most all of your antibiotics, you're going to make sure that you educate the patient to complete the entire course of the antibiotic, as well as the potential need for a double barrier protection against pregnancy, because antibiotics tend to have a interaction with oral birth control medications. Your carbapenems, those should be pretty easy. Carbapenems, and they all end in penem, imipenem, and meropenem. Again, these destroy the bacterial cell wall, and these are usually your stronger antibiotics administered inpatient through IV. Obviously, we want to, make sure that we are monitoring our patient for those supra infections, which include overgrowth of yeast, as well as the destruction of your normal flora in the GI tract. Your interactions with the carbapenems, the most important one is going to be your valproic acid. And so if your patient is on valproic acid, you may have to increase, you would contact the doctor to increase the valproic acid while they're on the carbapenems, because the carbapenem, interacts and lowers the valproic acid levels. Vancomycin, you as a nurse will administer this frequently. The complications that you need to be aware of include the ototoxicity. Ototoxicity due to vancomycin is rare and reversible. So if your patient does begin to have reports of ringing in the ears or decreased hearing ability, you need to discontinue the use of the vancomycin, notify the provider, and get that changed over. Couple of other unique things about the vancomycin is that you have your peak and trough levels. And so you want to make sure that you're checking your peak and trough so that you're not putting too much of the vancomycin in the system at one time. And then And then you also want to monitor your kidney function for patients who have renal insufficiency. Hey. Tasha says hi to everybody. All right, your tetracyclines include your doxycycline and your minocycline. And so these medications have a couple of very unique side effects, including tooth discoloration as well as photosensitivity. So while patients are on this medication, you need to advise them to wear sunscreen, to avoid being out in the sun for prolonged periods of time. And then the tooth discoloration occurs only with your primary deciduous teeth. So beginning at 16 weeks of pregnancy, which is basically the fourth month, is when the fetus begins to develop teeth. So we would not administer tetracycline to anyone who is 16 weeks or more pregnant up to the age of 8 years. By the time a patient is 8 years old, we pretty much assume that they have all of their permanent teeth. All right, your macrolides is the last group. That includes erythromycin and azithromycin. And so these antibiotics, these are The oddity, the different thing about them is the risk for QT prolongation. And so anybody who has any history of any heart conditions or cardiac dysrhythmias, we need to make sure that we look at their QT intervals, because administering this medication could further elongate those. And so we would only administer these to patients who have a normal QT interval. It does interact, both of these medications interact with your warfarin and your digoxin. It reduces the metabolism of these medications. And so patients who are on warfarin, their blood will actually become thicker because the warfarin is not as effective. And then the digoxin is also less effective while taking the macrolide. So again, with all of the antibiotics, make sure they complete their entire course. Make sure they understand if they're on oral contraceptive medications that they may need to use a backup form of birth control. Monitor for your allergies. If any allergies develop, stop the medication, notify the provider. I think that's all I got. Do y'all have any specific questions?
Do you mind going over the opioid antagonist again?
The opioid antagonist, the naltrexone and the naloxone?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so these medications only work to block the opioid receptor sites. So in the absence of an opioid, they literally have no effect. You know, if a patient comes in and, you know, there is any concern that it could potentially be an opioid overdose, then you can administer the naltrexone, the naloxone. It is not going to affect them if it is not an opioid overdose. The biggest concern nursing-wise for it is that after you administer it, you may still have to continue to monitor your patient because the half-life of the naloxone and naltrexone is much shorter than the half-life of most of your opioid analgesics. And so the antidote is going to wear off before the problem wears off. And so usually within 60 to 90 minutes of administering the naltrexone or the naloxone, that opioid effect will resume. And so you may have to administer more than one dose of the naltrexone or naloxone because of the half-life.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Anything else? All right, and I think I covered it in an announcement or somewhere. I feel like I have already said it, but just to make sure that it's available to everyone equally. Your final exam consists of 50 questions. 30 questions come from the content that we just covered, and then you have 20 questions that are comprehensive that come from exam one and exam two. Again, the reviews for exam one and exam two are still available, so you can go back and re-listen to those if you need to. But 10 questions come from exam one, 10 questions come from exam two, and then you have 30 questions from the new content. Your exam will begin at 6 p.m. on Monday, so make sure you go in Sunday, go ahead and download and get it ready to go. I was told today that Ms. Emmons is going to be out of the office on Tuesday. So I'm not sure when that analysis will be finished, but either way, all grades will be posted Wednesday afternoon. So your final exam grade and everything will be available to you Wednesday afternoon. Any other questions, comments, concerns?
Thank you for the reviews.
You're welcome. All right, well, if nobody has anything else, I will let y'all get to studying.
Thank you.
Thank you.